She may have retired from teaching a few years ago, but Pamela Proctor has not stopped thinking about students and classrooms and education. In fact, she's still active on the Sunshine Coast where she lives now, and she's just written a book called Honoring the Child, Changing Ways of Teaching. In the book, Pamela tells a story of how working in England early in her career, in late 1950s, early 1960s, really, well, I guess, stopped her in her tracks and started her on a whole new way of educating children, a direction that led eventually to working in some of the first open classrooms in Vancouver. I talked to Pamela this past week, and I started by asking her to describe her 1950s class in Vancouver.
Straight rows of desks. This was standard throughout the system, Vancouver system. And then we had little chairs, which we put up every day for the groups to come forward for their reading lessons. We had A group, B group, and C group. And then while we were teaching the reading, or the phonics, or the printing, or whatever we were teaching, the children were doing their seat work, the other children. Sometimes at the blackboard and sometimes in their seats. Now, I got to be pretty good at this whole thing, and I was asked to be a helping teacher and have other teachers come and see what I was doing.
And you had a lovely, quiet classroom.
Oh, very. Yes. I used to literally hold a pen and drop it sometimes, because quiet was the way we were judged as teachers in a way. So then, of course, I went on exchange. Well, I was very, very, I would use the word flummoxed.
Right.
That's a good North of England word. I was flummoxed. I didn't know what to make of it. And I was quite critical of the idea that people didn't seem to be teaching the children.
What was it like? Can you describe a bit of what you saw there in those classrooms when you arrived?
First of all, there was no blackboard, nor chalkboard. Instead of paper and pencils and things for the children to use, there were some of those, but there were cupboards full of what the head teacher called apparatus. And I didn't know what to do with that. I thought that the children should do what I said they should do. And there was no room for any kind of their ideas, really. I just thought that I should know what they should do with this apparatus. It consisted of paint and paper and weighing scales and sand and water, that kind of thing.
Right.
It was foreign to me.
And you describe in there, too, how there seemed to be just sort of a constant hubbub in the classroom.
Oh.
Students coming up, students doing this, students in this corner and that corner.
Yeah. The deputy head had me visit for half a day, and I couldn't believe how noisy it was in her classroom and how active. And it was just confusing to me because I really had no idea what was going on. Well, I mean, I knew, I could see what was going on, but I had no idea how she got it to happen or what.
Or how it was even teaching.
How it was teaching. Gradually, with the help of Betty Luckman, who was the next door teacher, she said, follow what I do, and she showed me what she did, which was to take the children individually, get them to settled in their work, meaning their painting or their writing or their water play or whatever, get them settled, and then take them up to your desk individually and hear them read and talk to them and so on. So by Christmas, I was hooked. But, you know, I still didn't know what it was exactly. I liked it, but I didn't know what I was doing. I couldn't put words to it.
Pamela, what was going on? I mean, as you reflect on it now and in the book, what was going on in those classrooms that wasn't going on in your classroom in Vancouver?
What was going on is that children were making choices. Yeah, there was no coercion. I wasn't imposing anything. What was happening was coming from them, and they were working at their own pace.
And a child-centered approach, I guess, to use maybe some of the jargon.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was much more. And I got to know the children much more, and they were happier. Even a little boy who was just learning to print his name was very happy in school, and I'm not sure how he would have felt if he'd been in my Vancouver classroom. I know there were some tears there, and I talk about them in the book.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And that can still make me cry to think about that.
That little guy in the blackboard.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell that? You have to tell that story now, even though it make most of us sad.
It does. It would. Well, I was teaching it in my little group. I think it was probably B group at the front of, and I taught hard. I mean, I would fill that chalkboard over and over, and I had a lot of fun with it. I was like an actress. I would have fun with it. It wasn't all horrible or anything like that, you know, and there were many, many wonderful teachers, but it was just the way it was. And so I was teaching at the front, and I caught out of the corner of my eye, caught a little boy at the back of the room, and he was trying to write a word that I had copied on the board, which I had done every day, and he was trying to copy my word. And I could sense that there was a little trouble going on, and I could hear a little noise, and I realized he was sobbing. So I went down to the back, and he was standing there with his head against the board, and the tears were flowing, and the board was wet with his tears, and he just wasn't able to carry that out easily. And he had a patch over one eye, and you know, his coordination just wasn't ready for all that. And that stayed with me so well. And
that story is so, it gets you. And that was such a visual example. But as you say, there are so many students in a class that's run in a very sort of homogenized kind of way.
Yeah.
Where children are facing that kind of challenge every day, even if they aren't actually breaking down and crying.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Exactly. You know, it's very interesting. And then, of course, the failure rate, the testing we had to, I call it teach, test, rank, and fail. That's what we did. We taught, and then we tested the children, and then we ranked them from top to bottom and failed. And one year I had to fail 8. I mean, that was dreadful.
Pamela, you went back to England then, like you mentioned, you went back to school, and then you had another opportunity to go to England. And in the book, you describe this wonderful experience you had in a class where many of us had felt a great degree of trepidation. That's in gym class. Mm. But it was such a different kind of gym class.
Yes,
I think I would have even enjoyed that gym class.
You would have. It was absolutely amazing to me, because gym had been dreadful for me all of my school years. I had first of all, when I was young, there was no gym. But as I got into high school, when there was, it wasn't an easy thing. I can still remember being asked to turn a somersault. And I think I say in the book how, you know, put your hands here, your head here, and then they push you over. And, oh, my goodness, it was so uncomfortable. When I got to England, just to take that example, the teacher there said, find as many ways as you can to turn your body over.
Which is brilliant.
Oh, brilliant. Wow, I could do that. In many ways, even turn a somersault backwards and forwards, because there was no pressure. It was and it just made so much sense.
And bringing it back to your abilities and your exploration, which is what the theme is that runs through these classrooms then.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Exploring the possibilities.
Exactly. And I even looked into it in terms of music and everything. I mean, I retired too soon. I wish I could do it all over again. But it just can happen in every subject, you know. I mean, exploring in music is just as important, and certainly in art.
My guest this half hour is Pamela Proctor, and we're talking about her book, Honoring the Child. After those experiences in England, Pamela was keen to work in an open system in Vancouver. And after a few years, she was given the chance with several others like-minded teachers to start a new kind of school, an open concept school, in the new Charles Dickens Annex.
So we set it up, the open area part, as a big workshop. A lot of art activities in the wet area. We had painting and sand and water and sewing. We had science activities there. We had a playhouse then further along in the open area. And then we had huge blocks, planks and so on that the children built with, as well as big blocks, which were fair-sized blocks that fit together. All kinds of games and measuring materials and weighing materials. And next to that was the language area and the library. And So the whole place was like a great big workshop. The children, we divided the children into family groups. That doesn't mean there were families together, although in some cases some children were, brothers and sisters were together. But the family groups consisted of children from the ages of 4 to 9.
Right.
And each of us had that age group, age range. Now, I was worried about how I was ever going to send my children off and how I was going to run all over the school looking after them.
Because they'd be involved in different activities.
Exactly.
In different places, right?
But then I had to let go. I had to say, well, I trust my colleagues to look after them, and they'll trust their children to me, and that's how it worked. Children sat down with us, and they made their choices, and off they went to work. I mean, it was just like a lot of adults going off to a job. I mean, they just went off and very determined, and it was just a very, very special time.
It must have been amazing to watch that unfolding.
It was. Sometimes when I was writing the book, I thought, maybe I'm sounding like Pollyanna, you know, or that this is too good to be true. Of course we had days. Of course we had times when we had to stop everything and everyone had to sit down and we would say, well, we know it's a little noisy in here today. We need to keep our voices down. Or maybe things weren't getting tidied up. And the children knew that we couldn't do it all unless they cooperated in some way. They had to tidy up, and they had to, and they got the idea, and then we'd go off and get on with our activities again. But yeah, and then we had children who were upset too. I mean, it wasn't something that cured everything.
No.
We had to help these children. We had counselors, and I found, though, that children with emotional upsets were better off than they had been in the classrooms when I had worked in the more formal setting, because they were able to, I think doing the activity and being active helped, plus being involved with so many other children, they were constantly cooperating.
Collaborating.
Right. And the children, when I did a little research project and I asked some of the older children how the school had affected them, and they mentioned how they got along much better with others, they could make decisions more easily, how much more able they were to be comfortable socially.
And how did they do on the testing? Because, of course, always when they compare systems to systems, schools to schools, that's always the thing about, are you learning what you need to learn?
We had, in our second year, we were told we had to submit to a test. The children had to be tested to see how they were doing. Well, it wasn't very easy. First of all, we knew that the tests were meant for children who had paper and pencil activities. So what kinds of tests would test children who were involved in learning on such a broad front? They weren't just learning set skills in reading or language. They were learning in many ways. So we were told that we could have a few hours off to find some tests. So we set to work, and we found some. And maybe they were okay, but then the person who was testing wasn't really part of all that, and that was hard for her. So I have to say it didn't turn out very well.
And what was the response then? You know, I would think that a lot of parents would go, oh my gosh, my kids aren't getting the education they need, and they're coming into this school.
No, nobody withdrew their children. There was a lot of sympathy. We had a school board meeting in the middle of our school open area, and the decision was that we would continue. And what a relief.
And why were parents willing to continue, even in the face of that?
Well, I think they knew that it was special. Their children didn't want to stay home, even if they were sick. One parent I met a few years later had to leave the school. This is a separate issue now, but she had to leave the school. And she said, you know, we still have to drive by and see my school, she calls it.
Ah.
Yeah, we still have to drive by, even though they had left. Anyway, so that was the feeling.
So where is all that now? I mean, I hear what you're describing, and I think of some, say, classrooms in the public system that are run maybe a bit on a Montessori kind of a basis, which might be similar in some ways. And there may be others that I don't know about, but how is it now in the public system with regard to that kind of approach?
Yeah, and it's a difficult thing for people. I just have to say right now, the thing that's inspiring people is Reggio Emilia in Italy, which is a town in Italy where the children, young children are not, there's nothing imposed on the education of young children. They work through nature and art and other things, I guess. I haven't been there, but I've read a little bit about it. And that's what is inspiring many people in Canada even and the States to go to this more less formal way of working. But what's holding it back is that there seems to be a disconnection between what governments want and what teachers feel is most important. And so there are kinds of lists of things that children need to learn, and teachers have to keep track of it all, a lot of paperwork, and then the testing part, which is very, very discouraging. I mean, I worked in the inner city, and I just can't imagine how it must be imposing these tests on the children. And it's counterproductive when you're trying to encourage children and then give them a test which is so discouraging. There are many good things going on. Parents are starting to say, we would like something like this, especially on the Sunshine Coast. So we worked for a year. We haven't got it yet, but we worked for a year, and we'll still continue, I'm sure, in some way to try to get classes, you know, specifically, working specifically this way.
But wait a minute, aren't you retired?
Oh, yeah, right. Can't keep out of it. I still dream about it. I wonder sometimes if I'm a little obsessed, but not really. I feel privileged to have this and be able to share it. So I mentor a lot of teachers now.
Yeah, I don't think there's much chance that Pamela Proctor is going to retire. As we wrapped up the conversation, I asked her about that research that she did earlier when she interviewed some of the former Charles Dickens students and asked her to read some of their responses.
I'm just going to start with Maria. She said, I think that it helped me to cooperate better with other people and also be more outspoken. It helped my creative thinking a lot. Then Jessica said, the openness led her to the awareness of different methods, lifestyles, cultures, and ideas. Alan said, in some ways, these are teenagers by now, in some ways it helped me be what I am today, which is pretty good.
I love that.
That's fantastic.
Tyrone commented, I think that it would help me be more open about my feelings, share more, and be able to work with others in a group. Vanessa said, I learned to make decisions by myself and I knew what I wanted.
Amazing.
That's what got me started asking if I could question the children in the high school, because I saw a girl on the street one day and I asked her how she felt about it. And she said, when the teacher asks us to choose something or decide on what we wanted to do in terms of a project, she said, I always knew what I wanted to do. And she said a lot of the other kids didn't. And I could relate to that personally.
Yeah, you know, oh, sure. Yes. Sitting there with a blank slate.
Like,
yeah.
Now what?
Yeah.
You're not telling me what to do.
Exactly.
14-year-old Susanna found that attending the annex helped her to do things with confidence and to make friends. And 19-year-old Ian, who had been at the annex for 4 years and was entering the Royal Canadian Air Force to train to be a pilot, combat pilot, said, schooling when you are young is not so much about facts and figures, but rather interacting with other children. Dickens' annex did, I believe, instill the appropriate social skills in a child's mind, that child being myself. And Ian did become a pilot.
Who do you hope will read this book, Pamela?
Oh, I'm really hoping that new teachers will read it. I'm really hoping that any teachers will read it, and parents. And I really want everyone to have an understanding of this, because decisions are made about education and some people aren't thinking about it at all and have no idea and look at school the way they were schooled and think that was okay. It is fine for many children, no matter what they go through. I mean, even the testing, some children pay no attention to it. It's fine for them. I'm most concerned that we don't educate some at the expense of others. and that we really look after those most vulnerable, because those are the children that need our fullest support. We don't want gangs and children going off the rails because they haven't been, you know, fully supported as children.
Pamela, thank you so much. I have to tell you, I'm not a teacher, but I certainly found this a very inspiring book to read.
I appreciate that a lot. That's very nice to hear. And I hope that encourages other people to read it who aren't teachers.
That's Pamela Proctor, and the book we're talking about is Honoring the Child, Changing Ways of Teaching. And Pamela Proctor is going to be celebrating World Teachers Day at the Vancouver Public Library, the main branch in the Alice McKay Room. And that's coming up, rather, on the 4th of October, Saturday the 4th of October, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Pamela Proctor will be there reading from this book, and she'll be answering some questions. There will also be activities for children, as you might expect, and, as I say, a chance to meet Pamela and talk to her about her work. That's coming up at the Vancouver Public Library next Saturday, October the 4th, in the Alice McKay Room at